Hello and welcome to HN Pod. Today is September 26, 2025, and this is episode number 166.
We've got a great lineup of stories from the top of Hacker News today. We'll be talking about a new vision for social media called Open Social. Then we'll get into a pretty heated debate about the UK's plan for a compulsory digital ID for workers.
After that, we've got a classic Firefox engineering story about speeding up network I/O with Rust, a new protein folding model from Apple that claims to be much simpler than AlphaFold, and finally, a look at why US cities are paying way, way too much for public buses.
A lot to get through, so let's jump right in.
First up, we have a post from Dan Abramoff's blog, overreacted.io, titled Open Social. This one has 360 points and is getting a ton of discussion. He's arguing that we're at a similar moment with social media today as we were with open source software 35 years ago.
Right. His core analogy is that open source eventually won against closed source for the foundational infrastructure of the internet. And he believes Open Social will do the same for our social infrastructure. He uses the AT protocol, which powers Blue Sky, as his main example. The key idea here is data ownership. He paints this great picture of the early web. You had your own domain, say alice.com. You controlled it. If you didn't like your hosting provider, you could just move your files somewhere else, point your domain to the new server, and nobody would even notice. You owned your identity and your content.
But with what he calls closed social, Facebook, X, Instagram, your identity is at Alice on their platform. Your posts, your likes, your follows, all of it lives as rows in their private database. If you want to leave, you have to leave it all behind. You're trapped. Exactly. And the AT protocol tries to solve this. The idea is that your data, your posts, your social graph, lives in a personal data repository that you control. Different apps, like the Blue Sky app, are just views or clients that read from and write to your repository. If a new, better app comes along, you can just start using it without losing all your data and connections. You can walk away.
It's a really compelling vision. But the Hacker News comments, as always, add some crucial nuance. The top comment from Nightpool makes a fantastic point. They say that while AT protocol is great for data ownership, it's weaker than its main rival, ActivityPub, when it comes to data processing.
Can you break that down? What's the difference?
So AT protocol is built on this idea of a global, public view of the world. All the data from everyone's personal repositories gets fed into massive, centralized services called app views or indexers. These services are what build your feed, calculate like counts, and handle search. Blue Sky runs a big one, for example. ActivityPub, which powers Mastodon, is more like email or RSS. Your local server only has to worry about the people you follow. It's more federated.
Ah, so with AT protocol, you get this amazing data portability, but you might still be reliant on a few big centralized companies to actually make sense of all that data and give you a usable feed.
Precisely. The commenter points out this is why Blue Sky has struggled with features like private likes. In their global model, every like has to be public for the indexers to count it. In ActivityPub, a like can just be a private message between two servers. So it's a classic engineering trade-off. Portability and a global namespace versus true federation and privacy. It's not a subtle debate at all.
Fascinating. It feels like we're watching the future architecture of the social web being debated in real time.
Okay, next up, a story from Reuters that has sparked a massive debate. Britain to introduce compulsory digital ID for workers. This one is sitting at 323 points, and the comments are, let's say, skeptical.
That's putting it mildly. The reaction is overwhelmingly negative, but it's not a generic anti-tech sentiment. It's very specific to the UK context. The top comment from After Gibson lays it out perfectly. They say, a secure, optional digital ID could be useful, but not in today's UK, because the state has repeatedly shown it can't be trusted with data.
And they bring the receipts. They list the Snoopers Charter, which forces ISPs to log every website you visit for a year. The Investigatory Powers Act, which gives the government power to demand encryption backdoors. The Online Safety Act's content scanning powers. The huge, often secret, contracts with the surveillance firm Palantir. They make a very strong case that a universal digital ID would just plug directly into this existing surveillance ecosystem.
Another commenter, CosWSXDSech, makes a really sharp technical distinction. They point out that ID cards in many other European countries are physical credentials. The card itself holds the authority. The UK's proposal, however, is for the digital ID to be just a pointer to an entry in a centralized government database.
And that's the scary part. It means your right to work or access services isn't something you possess. It's a record in a database that can be changed or revoked at the stroke of a key, with no due process. It turns a right into a privilege that is centrally managed.
Now, a few people did push back, saying that even physical IDs, like your driver's license or passport, are already checked against centralized databases when you use them for anything important. So they're already just pointers.
That's true, but I think the core fear remains. With this new system, the database becomes the single source of truth for everything. And given the UK government's track record, the Hacker News community has zero trust that this power won't be abused. One commenter asked why this works fine in a country like the Netherlands, but seems so dangerous in the UK. And the consensus seems to be that it all comes down to a fundamental lack of trust in the government's competence and intentions.
A very cautionary tale about how technology is never just about the tech. It's about the social and political context it's deployed in.
Let's shift gears to a more optimistic engineering story. Fast UDP I/O for Firefox in Rust, from the blog of Max Inden, an engineer at Mozilla. It has 291 points.
This is a classic HN-style post. Firefox is replacing a very old piece of its networking code, called NSPR, the N stands for Netscape, with a modern implementation in Rust.
The context here is that about 20% of Firefox's traffic is now HTTP/3, which runs on a protocol called QUIC, which itself runs on UDP. The old Netscape-era code was sending one tiny UDP packet at a time, which is really inefficient. Each packet requires a system call, which means switching from user space to kernel space, and that's expensive when you're doing it thousands of times a second.
So the new Rust code uses modern operating system features to speed things up. They talk about two main techniques. The first is batching, where you bundle up a bunch of packets and send them to the kernel with a single system call. The second is segmentation offloading, where you give the OS one giant packet and let the network card itself chop it up into smaller pieces.
And the results are pretty stunning. In their CPU-bound benchmarks, they saw throughput jump from less than 1 gigabit per second to 4 gigabits per second. That's a 400% increase. As one commenter pointed out, that's not just about raw speed. It means lower CPU usage, which translates directly to better battery life on laptops and phones. A huge win.
But this being Hacker News, the top comment thread immediately says, 4 gigabits? That's not fast.
Of course. A commenter named Veserv does some back-of-the-envelope math and argues that even with all the improvements, there's still a lot of performance being left on the table. Another user, Raggy, jumps in to explain why. They point to things like the overhead from Spectre and Meltdown mitigations, which made system calls much more expensive. They also mentioned that cryptography is particularly slow on the small packets that QUIC often uses, and that the default UDP buffer sizes in most operating systems are tiny, a holdover from the 90s.
So it's a great example of peeling back the layers of a problem. The Firefox team made a huge improvement by optimizing their application code. But the HN comments reveal all these deeper, system-level bottlenecks that are still holding things back. It's a win for Firefox, but also a great lesson in high-performance networking.
All right, our next story is from Apple's GitHub repository. It's called SimpleFold. Folding proteins is simpler than you think, and it's at 219 points.
This is Apple's new AI model for predicting the 3D structure of proteins, which is a huge problem in biology and medicine. The big claim, as the name suggests, is its simplicity. Unlike Google's AlphaFold, which uses a lot of complex, custom-designed architectural components inspired by biology, SimpleFold uses a more generic, off-the-shelf transformer architecture.
The idea is that you don't need all that specialized, domain-specific engineering. You can just scale up a standard architecture, in this case to 3 billion parameters, and get competitive results. It seems like a big step forward, simplifying the whole approach.
It does, but the top comment from hashtag points out a massive, massive caveat that changes the whole story. The simple model wasn't trained on raw experimental data from labs. Most of its training data consists of protein structures that were predicted by the complex AlphaFold model.
Oh, so it's a distillation process. The complexity hasn't been eliminated, it's just been moved from the model's architecture into its training data. SimpleFold is essentially a student model that learned by copying the answers from the smarter, more complex teacher model.
Exactly. It's not that protein folding is inherently simple now, it's that this model wouldn't exist without the more complex model that came before it to generate its training set.
That said, another commenter, a dyslexic crow, had a more optimistic take. They see this as a natural progression in machine learning. First, a complex, bespoke model proves a task is possible. Then, a simpler, more general model learns to replicate its performance through distillation. This new, simpler model then becomes a better baseline that you can build upon, potentially adding back some complexity to achieve even better results. It's a cycle of innovation.
That's a great way to look at it. We also saw some nice nostalgia in the comments with people bringing up folding at home. Commenters clarified that folding at home is a physics-based simulation trying to understand the process of how a protein folds, while these new AI models are statistical predictors that just try to guess the final shape. They're complementary approaches to the same grand challenge.
Let's move to our final story. It's a Bloomberg article with the headline, U.S. Cities Pay Too Much for Buses. It's at 175 points.
The article opens with some really eye-popping numbers. In 2023, Denver's transit agency bought diesel buses for about $432,000 each. In Cincinnati, a different agency bought similar buses from the same manufacturer for $939,000 each, more than double the price.
And it gets crazier. That same year, Singapore bought fully electric buses, which are supposed to be more expensive, for just $333,000 each. So a diesel bus in Cincinnati costs nearly three times as much as an electric one in Singapore. The article blames things like a lack of competition, demands for custom features, and Buy America rules.
But the Hacker News comments immediately zeroed in on one sentence buried in the article. Federal funding typically covers 80% of bus purchases, with agencies responsible for the remainder.
And there it is. The top comment from Rob Core nails it. This is a classic principal-agent problem. The person making the purchasing decision, the transit agency, is only paying 20 cents on the dollar. When you're spending someone else's money, you're just not that sensitive to the price.
It creates all the wrong incentives. You're more likely to ask for expensive, custom features. You're less likely to negotiate hard on price. The manufacturers know this, so they price their products accordingly. Many commenters immediately drew the parallel to the U.S. healthcare system, where the patient is insulated from the true cost by insurance, leading to wildly inflated prices. It's the exact same dynamic.
Someone also brought up the Buy America provision. And it raises an interesting policy question. Is this a bug or a feature? Is the goal of the federal funding to get the cheapest possible buses for cities? Or is the goal to use taxpayer money to subsidize and support domestic manufacturing, even if it's less efficient and more expensive?
Right. It's a story that seems to be about buses, but it's really about how misaligned incentives can create incredibly inefficient outcomes. The problem isn't necessarily that anyone is corrupt. It's that the system is designed in a way that makes these high costs almost inevitable.
A perfect illustration of how incentives drive almost everything. And on that note, that's all the time we have for today.
We covered a lot. From the architectural debates of the future social web and the deep complexities of network performance, to the hidden assumptions in AI models and the economic incentives driving up the cost of public transit.
Thanks for tuning in to HN Pod. We'll be back tomorrow with more top stories from Hacker News.